I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. A little later, we'll find out how Africa and the Caribbean are helping Haiti regroup from the devastating earthquake last week. We'll also hear from our moms panel about how parents might have more spare time than they realize. That's coming up. But first, exactly 1 year ago today, Barack Obama was sworn in as the 44th President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
But a year after that historic moment, President Obama is confronting low approval ratings and criticism from both his political foes and allies. And now he faces a challenging new landscape in Congress. Scott Brown's victory in the race for the Massachusetts Senate seat yesterday will end the Democratic Party's 60-vote filibuster-proof majority.
I'm Scott Brown. I'm from Wrentham. And I drive a truck. And let me just say in conclusion, I am nobody's senator except yours.
So what's next for the Obama presidency, and where does his agenda stand 1 year after he took office? Joining us to discuss that is author and journalist Farah Chedaya, syndicated columnist and regular Tell Me More contributor Ruben Navarrete, and Raihan Salam, a fellow at the New America Foundation and co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Welcome to all of you to the program.
Thank you
for having us.
Raihan, let me start with you. As we mentioned, of course, it's the president's anniversary today, but who is celebrating? The Republicans. So what does this victory, Scott Brown's victory, in the very Democratic state of Massachusetts, say about what voters feel about the president now?
Well, I think that it's hard to say that it has any conclusive ideological meaning. I think that there was a lot of enthusiasm because there's a lot of frustration with incumbents of all political stripes. And I think that there is a lot of anger that's coming from both the right and the left, that the Democrats and Republicans are failing to really capture effectively. So I think that it's very unpredictable, very hard to say. This is certainly not good news for the Democrats or for the president's agenda, but I still think that there are ways he can turn it around.
Apparently, a lot of that anger has come from people who are very opposed to health care reform, perhaps in any form, but certainly in the form that is being discussed now. Farai, the irony here is that Scott Brown will be replacing Senator Edward Kennedy, who died last year. I mean, his whole life was about overhauling health care policy. Where does this change leave the plan?
Well, you know, first I want to say, and excuse me for the frog in my throat, that I don't think we really know whether or not this was largely a rejection of health care, because there was no exit polling. So we don't know whether these were ideological voters who were truly opposed to health care reform, whether they were people who liked, the winning candidate, disliked the losing candidate. We just don't have enough information. We can certainly say some people believed that, but there's no question that the overall game has changed on health care. And now the ball is in the Democrats' courts to decide what to do. Nick Kristof posted something on his Twitter feed that I thought was very interesting, which is he said, the House needs to pass the exact same bill as the Senate. Therefore, there would be no reconciliation needed. Therefore, health care would proceed. And he saw that as the only sort of, good faith option that would avoid these questions of messy political strategies. But I think that, everybody wants good health care. They just don't know how they want it. And it's a lot easier to reject a flawed plan than it is to come up with a workable one. So I suspect that even some of the people who were responsible for the victory in Massachusetts want some form of health care reform. I wish we had better numbers.
Well, I think what's interesting, and Raihan, let me turn to you now. And we do know that Scott Brown campaigned on his opposition to the Democratic health care plan, but he was campaigning in Massachusetts, which already has a statewide health insurance plan. And it's been interesting to hear the conversation coming out of Massachusetts about the concerns people had that their health insurance plan would be undermined by any national health insurance reform. So on some level, does this victory perhaps reflect a liberal disappointment in the health care overhaul plan that was being considered, that's being considered now?
Well, it could, but one could also just as easily say that, you know, the view is that Massachusetts achieved its own settlement that bears some resemblance to the democratic reform model at the federal level in some very broad sense. But actually, because this happened in a more homogeneous state politically, where you had this large Democratic majority working with then Republican Governor Romney, you ended up having a much stronger individual mandate. You ended up having much more consensus around how this would work. And so it's possible that at the state level, you can reach a much more workable compromise toward this form of universal coverage that is much harder to achieve at the federal level. And there are lots of folks, including on the left and on the right, who said that there are many aspects of this reform that are not really workable the way that they might be if you had more in the way of a political consensus that you're likely to have at the level of a state. So I don't think that it's really so much a left or right issue as, you know, can you make this work at the state level versus at the federal level? And I think it's fully consistent for Scott Brown, who backed RomneyCare, you know, before it actually came to pass, to say that universal works at the state level, not necessarily at the federal level.
Ruben Navarrete, how do you see Scott Brown's victory affecting the future of the health care reform?
Oh, it's huge, and not just in healthcare, but in all these issues. It's absolutely the right point that this changes the equation, that members of Congress now, Democrats, in fact, are saying, let's go slow on healthcare. It's a game changer, to use that phrase, because there go the Democrats' filibuster-proof majority, and it's that all-important 60. It means that they're going to have to reach across the aisle, and suddenly they're going to have to deal with Olympia Snow again and make, you know, deals with Republicans to see if they can get that extra vote in. And that's going to mean the death, the absolute certain death of the public option, which is, you know, as far as I and a lot of other people are concerned, that's fine with me. I think that has been the sort of the millstone dragging down the rest of healthcare debate. But let me correct, I think, a couple of misperceptions. This is not just about the spin coming out of the White House. This is a weak candidate. This was a local election. All the sorts of the same things we heard after Virginia and New Jersey. You know, this idea that somehow this is against incumbency. I know Celinda Lake, the pollster for Martha Coakley, said, oh, this is really about anti-incumbency around the country. This is not that. This is a firm and definitive rejection of the Obama agenda, which seems to many people to be going too far, too fast, at too great a cost economically. And what I was struck by is a poll that I saw the day before the election that said that 20% of Brown's voters were disgruntled Obama supporters, people who had supported Obama but woke up one morning and said, oh, wait a minute, this is not what I wanted. That is really significant, and I think that Obama and the White House need to take that to heart. They need to stop blaming Martha Coakley and realize that it wasn't Coakley that was a drag on Obama. It was Obama that was a drag on Coakley.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and we're reviewing the first year of the Obama presidency with journalists Raihan Salam, Farai Chidea, and Ruben Navarrete. I want to just focus a little bit for a moment on the question of the public option, Ruben, which you just brought up, because President Obama originally introduced when he originally introduced his vision for healthcare legislation, he immediately drew criticism about the public option. And, of course, that would offer a government-run healthcare plan. And this is how the president responded to that concern in a speech before a joint session of Congress last year. Let's listen to it.
It's worth noting that a strong majority of Americans still favor a public insurance option of the sort I've proposed tonight. But its impact shouldn't be exaggerated by the left or the right or the media. It is only one part of my plan and shouldn't be used as a handy excuse for the usual Washington ideological battles.
Now, Ruben, you seem to think that that became something that just brought the rest of the plans for health care reform down. But for some people, by discarding the public option, he gained a lot of criticism in some quarters on the left. So
absolutely.
Was it a strategic mistake?
Yeah, I think it was.
To compromise?
I think it was. I don't know if that's a compromise. I think that what he said basically was, I still support a public option, but if you send me a bill that doesn't have one, I won't veto it. And the people who went nuts over that were not the right-wingers. It was the left-wingers. It was Al Franken and company. It was Keith Overman, others. People started talking at that point about running someone against Obama as incomprehensive, as inconceivable as that seems to a lot of people. This idea that somehow Democrats would run against Obama from the left. They started saying that after he discarded the public option. And so now, if you've paid attention to the Senate debate, the health care debate, you understand that the Senate bill is really the stronger of the two bills in terms of support, stronger than the House bill, doesn't have a public option in the Senate, does have a public option in the House. And so the momentum's really gone that way. So there's a lot of disgruntled folks on the left who, if they were grading Obama, would give him failing grades across the board on a lot of issues where they think he's governing like a Republican.
Farai, let me bring you in on this because I'm curious. Do you think that sort of criticism coming from the left is justified, or do you think the president has accomplished more than he's really being given credit for in this year?
Well, you know, the question is not so much whether or not the criticism is justified or unjustified. That's not a question that absorbs me as much as this one. Who did people vote for? I think there's a fundamental problem in that a lot of people who voted for President Obama did not really understand his policies and did not understand that he was not a progressive candidate in the typical sense. He had some progressive ideas and some centrist ideas. And so when it came, for example, to the fiscal crisis in the United States and the way that he dealt with the banks, some progressives were very disappointed. But if they understood a little bit more about who he was before they voted for him, they might not have been so shocked. And so I think today is a day of reckoning in many ways. It's been, 1 year since President Obama took office. And a lot of the people who were more progressive are coming to realize that they essentially created a progressive candidate. In that book, Game Change, that everyone seems to be reading and certainly is selling like hotcakes, there's a moment where the authors describe discussions in the camp of candidate Clinton and say, you know, you can fight against a man, but you can't really campaign against a movement.
I want you to hold that thought because we're going to have to take
absolutely.
A break right now. We're going to continue this discussion and we're going to talk a little bit more about the economy when we return. We are talking with Farai Chidea, Ruben Navarrete and Raihan Salam. Stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll look into how the Caribbean and African nations are helping victims of the massive earthquake in Haiti. But first, we continue our discussion about President Obama's first year in office. With me are political commentators Raihan Salam, Farai Chidea, and Ruben Navarrete. Farai, let's continue with what you were saying before the short break and making the point that maybe people didn't quite understand who they were electing.
Exactly. I mean, really, all I would say to summarize was that, you know, in the book Game Change, they make a persuasive argument that Obama was a movement as much as an individual candidate. And in a movement, people matter. The herd matters. And so there was a groundswell of opinion for people who wanted change. They wanted a new administration that was different from the Bush administration. That doesn't mean that they completely understood Barack Obama as a leader and policymaker. Now they are coming to the reckoning that they may have voted for their ideals, but their, you know, sort of hard progressive ideals may not have been shared by the candidate.
Raihan, let's talk about the economy, because certainly that played a role in the Senate race in Massachusetts. What are your thoughts about the president's economic agenda? What should he be doing to address the recession and unemployment? Has he done enough?
Well, I think that the problem is that we're in this very uncertain environment. We have a series of really unprecedented things that have happened vis-a-vis the financial sector, et cetera. And so it's not a matter of just, well, we pull lever X and here's how it's going to work and we know exactly what's going to happen to employment levels, et cetera. My sense is that the Obama administration's approach has been one of experimentation. Let's do our best. Let's also try to bring Congress into the process. And it's actually kind of a tough thing to navigate because, well, then how do you make the case for example, a federal stimulus package that really reflected the interests of lots of Democratic legislators and literally three then Republican members of the Senate. I mean, it's very hard to really take ownership of something like that, and they certainly tried to do that. But again, this is this incredibly uncertain terrain, so it's hard not to feel at least somewhat sympathetic. My own view is that the federal stimulus package was very, very poorly designed in terms of trying to maintain and increase employment levels. But again, I mean, you know, these causal chains are really, really uncertain. So, you know, as someone who is on the right end of the spectrum, I would have liked to have seen something that was more tilted towards, say, an investment tax credit, something more tilted toward payroll tax relief. But, you know, had we tried that, I have no idea where exactly we'd be. I think we'd perhaps be in a somewhat better place. But these are really open questions, and I do sense that folks within the administration try to struggle with them somewhat honestly while also trying to hold on to that Democratic majority, keep folks on side. And that's tough.
Reuben, how would you rate the president on the economy?
Not very well. I think I'd have to give him a near failing grade on the economy. There are other things he's done correctly, things I think he deserves credit for. Sticking to his word on Afghanistan, troop surge, starting the healthcare debate, in fact. But with the economy, he would have done himself so much good. He'd be riding high in the polls. Massachusetts may have gone differently had he just focused in on jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, you can't lose with that. And now I come from the newspaper industry where it's no small thing to talk about people being laid off and, you know, publishers talking about a jobless recovery. We may recover, but it's going to be a jobless recovery. Jobs are obviously the number one issue. And instead, what you see from Washington is a tendency of trying to take over things, take over General Motors, take over healthcare, you know, with the bailouts, take over the banks. That's not what I think the people of Massachusetts and the people around the country want. They want to focus in on what can you do to stimulate job growth in this country? None of those things have worked. And it's still pretty dark days ahead. You know, you're 10-11%, almost 11% unemployment around the country. And the last figure, I think, was 10 and 10.5 before that. And now in California, you know, a blue state, you're at about 12.5% unemployment. So I think the president from this point on would have done himself a lot, will do himself a lot of good if he can just focus in on jobs, keep it real, keep it down to the basics, what people want. And don't try to tell people what you think they need, but just listen to them and hear what they want.
And Farai, the African-American community and other minority communities have been especially hard hit by the economy, high unemployment rates, high foreclosure rates. What could the president be doing more? What more could he be doing to help minority and other economically disadvantaged communities and at the same time not neglecting the needs of the middle class?
Well, you know, this it's been a really fascinating moment where the Congressional Black Caucus kind of hip-checked the president and said, you can't use non-racial remedies to deal with the fact that there is a racial difference in the unemployment rate, and there always has been. And first of all, the unemployment rate isn't even the unemployment rate because of the way that it's calculated. You have people who are called discouraged workers. So you always have more people unemployed than the typical unemployment rate. And the economist Julianne Malveau makes the point that the de facto joblessness rate in Black America could be as high as 27%. You know, that is staggering, but, you know, this is from, you know, Labor Department statistics. So what I think that, you know, there's an attempt to foster programs like Cash for Caulkers to, you know, get people to take care of their homes, because you see a domino effect. When you have a working community, Black or otherwise, and people lose their jobs, they're protecting the housing stock of this country. When they have no money to protect the housing stock, you see the roofs start to go, you see the lawns start to go, you see, of course, home ownership start to go, and there's this domino effect where the neighborhoods physically degrade when people don't have jobs. I think that you need to focus on the government needs to focus on small business creation and maintenance and growth, and also recognize there are a lot of people who are cobbling together economic lives out of various actions that might be viewed as sole proprietorships. A lot of people who were working for companies who now have to pay their own Social Security taxes. What if you cut, if you want to talk about direct relief, what if you cut a break for a certain percentage of the Social Security taxes that self-employed people would have to pay? Those are people who are working, who are now taking a hit for working for themselves instead of for a company. There's simple things like that that should be put on the table.
And also quickly, Reuben, what about immigration? How would you score the president on that?
You know, it's a mixed message. He keeps saying the right things before Hispanic groups. He talks about how he wants to do it. He wanted to do it in the first 100 days, the first year of the administration. That didn't happen. Now people are already pronouncing it dead for 2010. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, but no thanks to the president. I think he deserves some credit for at least saying the right things, but a lot of Hispanics, Luis Gutierrez in the Congress and others, are voicing the same concern that African Americans are voicing about job growth and joblessness in the black community. You're not doing enough. And, you know, at some point, words aren't enough. You need to really deliver on some of these promises. And I think that's going to be a challenge for him. He hasn't really delivered on any kind of immigration reform plan. And I think that he should. And I think that he probably owes it not just to his Latino supporters, but also to the whole country to fix a system that's broken.
And finally, Raihan, I wanted to ask about President Obama's response to the earthquake in Haiti. He's pledged $100 million. He sent the military to help with relief. Is he doing enough? What more should he be doing, Raihan?
Well, that's really hard to say. I mean, I think that in the grand scheme of things, there are deep questions about whether or not Haiti is in the medium term a viable society for its population of 9 million. You saw the administration decide, I think wisely and rightly, to allow temporary protected status to undocumented workers from Haiti. Now, that's a very, very controversial move. One of the reasons why we might not see comprehensive immigration reform is that in a time of economic contraction and time of high economic anxiety, it's not obvious that lots of Americans, whether Democrats or Republicans, are going to be comfortable with the prospect of a very large immigrant influx. And I think that Haiti is going to be an issue we're going to be dealing with not for the next year, but rather for the next 10 years. And some people have suggested, and I think rightly, that this could be the defining issue of the Obama presidency, certainly one of the defining issues. So are we doing enough? I don't think that we fully appreciate the scale of the challenge involved when a country with a population of 9 million really sees its human and physical infrastructure collapse over a really short period of time. And so I think that that's something we're all going to have to deal with for a long time.
Okay, with just a brief time left, Farai or Ruben, anything to add to that on Haiti?
What I would say is that, you know, we have to remember that Haiti paid the equivalent of $20 billion U.S. to buy its own freedom from France when France was its colonial power. This is not a country that had to be this poor. This is a country that could have had earthquake-resistant infrastructure. We cannot continue to keep them in a debtor status when, in fact, they were in the crosshairs of post-colonial payback. So we got to stop looking at them as people who mismanaged their country and also look at them in a broader context.
All right. Thanks.
I'd give the president high marks for Haiti.
All right. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. Farai Jadeja is a journalist and political commentator. Raihan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation, and they both joined us from our New York studios. And Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist and a regular Tell Me More contributor, and he joined us from San Diego. Thanks again to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.